Good morning. Thank you for getting up so early. We really appreciate your doing this. We're hoping that this will be, we're going to flip through our slides relatively quickly because we're really hoping to have this more as a conversation with you. Much of the material that we're presenting is now available in written form, so I hate reading. I'm assuming you can go home and do the reading. And I think what's more important is a chance for you to help us talk a little bit about where we go from here and how we might think about this experience and where it goes, and that's really important. So I'm Susan Reverby. I'm a medical historian. I teach at Wellesley College. My colleagues on this panel are Valerie Bonham, who is the executive director of the Presidential Commission on Bioethical Issues, was asked by the president to do a long, more historical report on what I had found in the archives, and then to also help shape, and the commission is helping to shape a conversation about what kind of human subject protection we have, especially for research that is done off the U.S. shores. And to Valerie's right is Paul Lombardo. He's a lawyer and a historian of medicine as well, teaches at Georgia State College of Law, and he was an advisor to the Bioethics Commission. So I'm going to start and talk just briefly about the study itself and sort of how we might think about it and how we ever even found out about it, because I think one of the interesting questions is, you know, I think there's a joke Paul and I are starting to talk about that says a historian walks into an archive that goes something like how this happened. And for those who don't know my other work, I'm primarily a historian of the Tuskegee, what we call the Tuskegee syphilis study. I've edited a book and taught and written another one on it. So I want to remind you basically that for those of you who watch television, that at the end of the episode in Grey's Anatomy last spring, one of the things that happens is that Meredith, the doctor on the right here, breaks a double-blinded study to help a patient and her husband, who's running this huge AIDS, it's a Alzheimer's study, is furious at her about it. And it raised, I thought, in prime time, a really interesting question about who do you owe responsibility to? So is it the patient standing in front of you, or is it to the future? Who are you? And she says, but it was Adele. I needed to break the double blindness of the study. And the husband says, but there would have been millions of people that would have been saved, and now we can't do this study any longer. And I thought it did a nice job of raising for the public some of the issues we have to confront. The other phrase that I found, which I think really shapes the way I think about this study, came from the late film director Sidney Lumet. And I want to just remind you of his two sentences here, which I think sums up some of the issues that we're dealing with. For Lumet told us that in a well-written drama, and I would argue in a well-written historical piece as well, the story comes out of the characters. That is, we don't know what we're going to find when we go into an archive or start to write. We hope that when we understand what happened to people that we were studying, we learn their story. We learn to create how they themselves made history. The problem is often this gets written or reported as if it were, quote, melodrama. And then Lumet reminds us that in a melodrama, the characters in a well-written melodrama, he says, come out of the story. That is, we already know what's going to happen. We know that there's going to be Dudley Do-Right. We know that Pauline will be tied up against the rails and that somebody on a white horse will come and save her. And we have these kind of stock characters. It's very comforting. We sort of know what's going to happen. It's like the joke my partner and I always have that when we watch a movie that the black guy's always going to get killed first. That there's a sort of expectations of what happens that's sort of normative, and particularly in race stories, that's often what goes on. And what I think in many of us who are trying to understand this think that there are real limitations to the kinds of policy you make if you only think in melodramatic terms, and that we're really interested in understanding why you need to tell this story as good history and as good drama. So I just want to remind you of the importance of studies on syphilis in this time period. This is a wonderful chart which reminds you of the crude mortality rate for in the early 20th century for both syphilis and AIDS, to remind you how important the disease was, and a reminder that William Osler once said that he, assuming all doctors were male, of course, that if he who knows syphilis knows medicine, because it had such an enormous effect. It also was a period in which it was very difficult to speak about syphilis publicly. Surgeon General Thomas Perrin in the 30s was kept off CBS radio because he wanted to use the word syphilis in public. It's a little bit like how long it took Reagan to ever mention the word AIDS in public. And there were many terms used to pretend what was syphilis. One of the most common, of course, and those of you know the magisterial work on the Tuskegee study by Jim Jones, his book is called Bad Blood. I found this poster, which I thought was fascinating. It was in the Department of Corrections in New York in the 1930s, and it says very clearly, "Your blood is bad means you have syphilis." So I thought it was fascinating that this was not just a Southern colloquialism that was being used in Alabama, but was something throughout the country. I'm assuming for this audience in particular, I do not have to tell you what the Tuskegee quote-unquote syphilis study was. I just want to remind you that it started in 1932, that African-American men were the unknowing subjects and controls, that the study went on for 40 years through the civil rights era, through the penicillin era, only closes when there is a media outcry in 1972. If you're interested in it, the men's medical records are actually all available. They're in the in Morrow, Georgia, outside of Atlanta, in the Southeast Regional National Archives. And when I coded them, it became clear that there were, I think, altogether 624 men in the study, from what we can tell, 427 with syphilis, 185 controls, and then for those of you who do research, you'll love this, the 12 controls who got syphilis were then switched into the syphilitic arm. When they did the autopsy, some of the men proved not to have syphilis. They were never switched into the control arm. I think the key point I want to make here, and it explains what was so important for me in finding the material on Guatemala, is that the government did not infect anybody in Tuskegee. It's really, so it's a study of late latent syphilis. Most of the men were supposed to be, although they all weren't, 5 years out from infection. This was never an infecting study at all. And I have argued elsewhere in print that I actually think it makes the racism worse, because this is really a study in which people were watched. So this is a photograph taken in the 1950s. This is Eunice Rivers Laurie, the African-American nurse who is the go-between the men and the public health service. She's handing out a packet of aspirins to one of the men in the study. This is a photograph of the study for one of the diagnostic spinal taps, in which the men were essentially told it was, quote, a special treatment. This is a photograph. I was part of the Legacy Committee. A number of us finally realized that there needed to be a federal apology. It took us a couple of years to convince the government to do this, but in 1997, President Clinton apologized on behalf of the American government to six of the remaining survivors of that study. There are five of them who were well enough to be there. We've now lost all of the men passed in 2004, and their wives all passed by 2009. So one of the problems is that these stories about this kind of horror often take place in very melodramatic terms, and I'd like to remind you that many of our most famous melodrama movies often take place in that kind of terminology. So I'd like to remind you that one of the earliest films, silent films, is actually The Cabin of Dr. Kilgari. There's The Island of Lost Souls that came out in the 30s, and then, of course, there's Frankenstein. And we have this sort of terror, almost primordial terror, of the dangerous doctor hidden away in his laboratory doing something. One of the ways that this story circulates that I think is important comes from this, and it's a little hard because of the lights, this photograph, which is of Dr. David Albritton doing a blood draw in Tuskegee. And if you could see the picture, you'll notice he's got his thumb on the syringe. He's actually pulling, he's doing a blood draw in this picture. But the picture often, or versions of this photograph, often get cropped and circulated so that the idea looks like he's injecting somebody. So here's, for example, the PR for a show that was in a Dateline program that was in Australia this past June that was about what happened in Guatemala. They pulled one of the pictures from Tuskegee. You can see it on the left. That's a Tuskegee picture, and it says infected, and there's obviously a syringe. Now, those are your medical and public health personnel can tell he's pulling the syringe down, but you would never know that. All you see is a white hand on a black arm talking about, and the visual tells you what you think you're supposed to know. So let me move a little bit. So understand, I'm a historian of the Tuskegee Syphilis Study. I'm in the archives in Pittsburgh looking at Thomas Perrin's papers, and I discover that there are also papers there for John Cutler, who is one of the physicians who was worked in Tuskegee. And many of us, and many of you probably have seen him visually on television, because in a 1993 documentary called Deadly Deception, he's one of the two Tuskegee doctors who worked on Tuskegee, who stands there and says, it wasn't so bad, we really didn't, you know, we were really helping people, blah, blah, blah. And you basically, it's just pretty horrifying. And one of the reasons we pushed for the apology was we were very clear that, in fact, oh my goodness, that no apology had ever been issued, and that the doctors were still not contrite 25 years later. So there was, in 1946, a real concern with whether or not there could be prophylaxis. The lights just keep switching here. For STDs, in particular for syphilis and gonorrhea, which is a real problem for the Army. And this is 3 years after penicillin proves successful for the treatment of syphilis. And people aren't sure. This is a period where we're not even sure what penicillin can do. They're starting to do a lot of research. And this is a period where they're actually recovering penicillin from patients' urine because there's so little of it available. And the question becomes, could penicillin work as a prophylaxis, not just as a treatment for gonorrhea? So there's a gonorrhea and syphilis. There's a study, and I'm going to skip over this quickly because Val's going to talk about this in more detail. There was a study done in 1943 at the Terre Haute Penitentiary in which it was an attempt to give the men gonorrhea and then to attempt to cure them and see whether or not penicillin would work for what would work as a prophylaxis. And you can raise the question of it there, at least in Terre Haute, and the Bioethics Commission will talk more about this. In Terre Haute, the men were asked to give informed consent, although Henri Bloom, one of the men who worked in the public health service in that study in Terre Haute, in an oral history done in the 90s, now again it's in the 90s, looking back on his career earlier, says very clearly, you know, yeah, we said we would write a letter to their parole board and we gave them money for cigarettes and for some food at the canteen in the prison. Does that count as real informed consent, or can you think of that as coercive? So I think it's worth thinking about whether or not there really was informed consent in a meaningful way in a prison. In any event, what happens is that Dr. Cutler and a man named Juan Funes, who's the director of venereal disease in Guatemala, decide and help think up a study that will take place in Guatemala starting in 1946. They get permission from a number of the ministries within the Guatemalan government, and Val will talk about this in more detail. They get permission from a study section at the NIH to do this study. This is a wonderful photograph of what Cutler looked like when many of us saw him on the movies in the 90s. This is the picture the Bioethics Commission found, which I think is great, of him when he was 31 years old and was doing the study. And the question becomes, as the details come out and as you see the newspaper coverage, was he a monster? Was he just doing his job? Or, as I've argued elsewhere, if he had been right, would he have gotten a Nobel Prize for having found this prophylaxis or syphilis? So the study, the purpose of the study, so what happened is that I'm in the archives in Pittsburgh and I find these unpublished papers, and it says inoculation syphilis. And you can imagine my surprise on this, in part because I've spent now 20 years of my life saying to everybody, oh no one was given syphilis, right, in Tuskegee, and there's Cutler, and there's this paper, and I'm thinking, oh my God, what am I supposed to do with it? Except that it was also supposed to be a treatment study. So it looks very different to me than Tuskegee. And there are hundreds and hundreds of men's medical records in the files and his long field notes. And he says in the notes that the purpose of this was to study prophylaxis against syphilis, as well as some, they were doing some laboratory work as well on this. And I'm going to go through this quickly and let Val talk about this more, because they spent much more time than I did going through the details. But the idea of this study was to try and study what could be used as a prophylaxis. There was a long relationship between the Pan American Sanitary Bureau, now PAHO, with the United States government, and they needed a way to deliver the infection. Remember, this is an STD. So prostitution was legal in Guatemala at the time, but more importantly for this study, it was legal to bring a sex worker into the prison to have sex with a prisoner. So now you have a delivery system for an STD. So what happens is that Cutler, they organized this study in which local prostitutes who at the time are infected with syphilis and gonorrhea, and I think some of the more careful research has suggested some who they also infected, were allowed to go into the prison and have sex with the prisoners. They timed them, they plied them with alcohol, they counted how many times they had intercourse, and they really attempted to see whether or not the disease could be passed and what could be done to prevent infection. They had a lot of trouble in the prison. The prisoners were not so, even with the free sex, which your tax dollars paid for, they were not happy about all the blood draws that had to be done, and so they were having trouble getting people to sort of agree to continue this. They then moved on to a national orphanage study where they did not infect anyone. This was a blood draw study in which they were looking at the antigens used in the study. No one, as far as I can tell from these records, was given syphilis in the orphanage. They then moved on to the National Mental Health Hospital and to the Army Barracks. And here they couldn't use prostitutes, so this is where they start making an inoculum. And it turns out that rabbits can also get syphilis, so the rabbits are being flown in from the BDRL, the Venereal Disease Research Lab in Staten Island. They're making an inoculum from the rabbits, and they're transferring it to the patients in this hospital. And it's fairly clear that I think from the records that the director of the mental hospital didn't know exactly what was going on, and there was this trade-off. And frankly, this is the quote for me in the records that was the most horrifying, because I think it's such a reminder of what happens in under-resourced areas in which people have so little that any trade-off becomes reasonable. So here they bought a refrigerator, a motion picture projector, but the thing that got me, frankly, was the metal cups, plates, and forks to supplement the completely inadequate supply in the hospital. So it gives you some sense of how little people had and why the inducement of the study would have been so powerful. This is an example of one of the medical records to give you a sense of what went on. So one of the ways in which they delivered the inoculum was the scarification of men's penises. They looked for men with a long foreskin. They would pull back the foreskin of the penis. They would abrade it slightly. They took, this is Nichols rabbit, which is the strain of the disease in which rabbit, and they would drip the inoculum on a gauze pad, and what I thought was stunning, the circles are actually mine here, 816, 839, 905, so it goes on for 45 minutes, an hour and a half, and then they remove it and hope that they've delivered the disease. Often they did not. So clearly, there's deception and ethical questions. The officials in the hospital were not told the inoculum contained the bacteria that causes syphilis. There's correspondence between Cutler and his people who are running the study and above him and the Public Health Service. And there's this quote that we have from secondhand, of course, for those of you who are defense attorney types might play with this, in which Dr. Perrin says, look, we couldn't do this in the United States, although it's not clear, frankly, contextually, whether he means this kind of study or whether we just couldn't work with prostitutes in quite the same way. So it's worth thinking about this. And R.C. Arnold, one of the heroes of public health, actually, for his discovery of the use of penicillin, also reminds Cutler that we better keep this a little bit quiet, that if a goody organization found out about it, there would be a lot of tension around it. And I think one of the things that's interesting about this study, and Val and Paul will talk about this more, they knew what they were doing was on an ethical edge, and they kept it going. However, by 1948, it becomes clear that penicillin actually works as a cure for early syphilis, even though there's questions about anaphylactic shock and Herxheimer reaction, a number of medical issues. And the BD division's actually getting less money from the United States government, and so Cutler is essentially told to close the study up and to come home and be sent off to other positions. He leaves some of the supplies for the Guatemalans, and he returns to the U.S. for another assignment. So I just want to remind you in summary that in the Guatemala study, the subjects are both men and women, and they are being given syphilis and other STDs. In Alabama, the men already had the disease and were supposed to be in late latency, though not everybody was. In Guatemala, the subjects were given penicillin. Of course, not everyone is cured, and we'll talk some more about some of these numbers. And especially the sex workers are presumably left untreated, as far as we can tell from the records. In Alabama, the men were kept from treatment, although I've argued in my book and my articles that not always successfully, and that several of the men, certainly who survived into the antibiotic era, actually made it to treatment. So how do we know anything about this? What's fascinating is that John Cutler, who published more than 50 articles, if you Google him in PubMed, you'll see them, gave his these papers. All of this had never been really published, one little blood study, but that's it. Gave the papers to the University of Pittsburgh, where he taught, to the archives. In 2003, I was there doing the research on my Tuskegee book, and I found them. I thought this would just be a little part of the book, but I had to cut 150 pages out of the book, and it went. So when I went back to my notes in 2009, I suddenly thought, oh, my God, really, what is this? And I went back to the archives. I spent another week there looking at it. And I gave it as a paper at the American Association for the History of Medicine, my professional association, in May of 2010. And then it was going to be published in January of 2011 in a pretty obscure history journal that I don't even read, called the Journal of Policy History, right? So this was just going to be a kind of, you know, outtake article we all do. However, in the process of doing the work on the on my book for Tuskegee, on Tuskegee, I made friends with a really remarkable person who I think, frankly, is the hero of this story in many ways, and that's David Sensor, who we lost this past May. Dave was the former director of the CDC, who played not a terrific role, actually, in Tuskegee, because in 1969, there was a meeting which he chaired in which the decision was made to keep the Tuskegee study going. And if he had stopped it in 69, we probably would never have known about it. It would have just stayed buried in the story. And then when all hell broke loose, he was actually burned in effigy outside CDC's headquarters in 1972 by SDS. And I told him I probably would have been there burning him had I lived in Atlanta. But I told him about the study. I asked him to read my paper, and he immediately called me up and said, oh, my God, Susan, this is just horrific. CDC needs to know about this. And I said, oh, come on, Dave, this is going to be an obscure history journal. Nobody's going to read this. And he said, oh, no, no, this is in the age of the Internet, he says. He's 86. Dave says to me, this is going to get out, and then CDC's going to look like idiots. So I said, fine. So he gave it to CDC. They then got concerned about it, clearly. They sent John Douglas, the country's syphilis, one of the country's syphilis experts, to Pittsburgh to look at the data. I spent a couple of days really sweating it out because I'd been refereed by historians and now I was going to be refereed by a syphilis expert. And Douglas came back, confirmed my findings, and then the material went to NIH and then it went up the chain of command. As far as I understand, this is all above my pay grade, so I can't exactly tell you. And the decision was made, unlike this New Yorker cartoon where the lawyer says very clearly, first admit no harm, our government actually began at least a debate about whether or not we had to explain what had happened here and why it was important. So this is what the coverage looked like in Prensa Libre in Guatemala City. This is a cartoon from Prensa Libre in which the United States government is looking in the mirror and sees Dr. Mengele, the Nazi war criminal and physician, staring back. This is what the Times coverage looked like. So I want to speak briefly now about the coverage and then conclude. The United States, as you know, usually doesn't apologize to other countries, or as a friend of mine put it, to foreigners, for anything. So this was a really big deal when the decision was made. The details are, in fact, gruesome and involve sex. The story fits, I would argue, the trope, as I tried to suggest, of a grade B horror movie where the intrepid explorer is now a historian and walks into an archive and the seemingly single doctor is a monster. There is, of course, underlying mistrust of medical research in general, especially when tied to the government and especially when it happens outside U.S. borders. There is growing conversation in our country and elsewhere about the extent of testing and research by U.S. companies outside our borders at this time. So there was an apology, as many of you, all of you know, on October 1st by Secretary Sebelius and Clinton, and President Obama called President Colon in Guatemala, and then the Bioethics Commission has done this report. There was awareness that we needed to acknowledge an historical wrongdoing. There was a need to get ahead of the story. I think they learned a lot from what happened with Tuskegee before it got picked up by the media, not afterward, which is what happened with Tuskegee. There was, of course, this debate going on about international subject protection, and as many of you know, changes in the IRB ruling. So it came at, I think, at the right historic time for that. So I have some final thoughts about the coverage. I think it's really important to remember, I think, that Cutler and his colleagues thought they were doing good science, even if we could argue that it was not, against a dreadful disease. There is the danger that if we see this only as the bad old days and as them doing, quote, just bad science, no one will imagine that this isn't something they can just put away as a kind of melodramatic moment. I think it's really dangerous to see Cutler as a kind of lone gunman monster. I literally, there's one newspaper story that said Cutler was a monster. It's dangerous. And I think if we think about the parallel to Mengele, we have to consider the extent to which this was work supported by the government and thought of as good science at the time, even if we might not think so. I think we need to worry about the fact that the majority of drugs coming into the U.S. and approved by the FDA are based on studies done outside the United States, so the issue of what kind of protection we provide internationally is really critical. We have to think about the role of the Guatemalan state in all of this because it's crucial to think about how people in under-resourced areas find themselves in these kind of positions and what kind of awful choices we are asking people to make. How do we think about the discussion on human subjects I'm hoping you'll participate in, whether we need better regulation, how do we train researchers to think about this, and what happens for what kind of standard. So what's happening right now is the Bioethics Issues Commission has released its report, which Val and Paul are going to speak about. There is a lawsuit filed under something called the Alien Tort Statute that has been filed that is going on at the moment. The Cutler papers that were in the Pittsburgh Archives are now online in the National Archives. All of you can watch them. And the debate is continuing over human subject protection. I want to conclude by saying what worries me the most here is actually the melodrama. Jay Katz, our beloved bioethicist who passed away a few years ago, Jay had a great line when he talked about Nuremberg, and he said the problem was that people saw it as a code only for barbarians. And my colleague Jim Jones, who just walked in the back, my favorite quote in Jim's book on Tuskegee is when Jim asked Dr. John Heller, who works on the Tuskegee study, didn't Nuremberg give them pause? And Heller looked at Jim during that interview, as Jim tells it, and says, but they were Nazis. And I worry enormously that that same view, that someone will look at Cutler and say, oh, this was monstrous a long time ago, they were imperialist running dogs, or the people in Tuskegee were racist. We couldn't do that. So I think it's really critical for us to think about how we might identify with both the researchers and the subjects and controls in these studies. I think we should never forget that our passion for what we do, if you think about being a good scientific researcher, it's because you have passion for what you're doing, because you think your work is really important, and how, like all lust and love, can be blinding, that this can sometimes blind us to what is going on. Think about the fact that you don't want somebody like me finding this in your archive in 50 years. That's another reminder, and then your children will have to deal with this all over the national news. And we should think hard together about how best to educate researchers about this so it doesn't just get put away as something that the barbarians did. So thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it. I'm going to turn it over now to Val. Okay, so I do a scale presentation. Ah, no. Okay, that didn't work. Okay, damn. Okay. Now, let's see. I'm sorry. Tell me what to do. Okay. Damn. exactly what he told me. See if we can do this. Maybe it just goes right through. I'm sorry about this. Hold on. Ah, there. Got it. Can be taught. There we go. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Susan. So thank you all for coming. I am, as Susan mentioned, am the director of the President's Bioethics Commission. And the Bioethics Commission, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, is a standing... Sorry. Better? Okay. The President's Bioethics Commission is a standing committee of independent experts that advise the President on various issues related to technology and science and medicine and ethics. They were created by President Obama. They are chaired by Dr. Amy Gutman, the president of Penn, who is a political philosopher and ethicist, and vice-chaired by Jim Wagner, who is the president of Emory and engineer by training. The President's Commission first heard of the Tuskegee events in the way that Susan described to you. It went through government channels, and on October 1st, the United States apologized, and they announced plans for an independent investigation. As Susan alluded to you, the October 1st apology and announcement resulted in fairly phenomenal media attention, relatively speaking, some might say, for an event so old. I would say to you, not surprising at all for the content of the event. Subsequently, on the 24th of November, the President charged the Bioethics Commission to do two things. First, do an independent historical investigation into what happened in Guatemala. And the second was to do a contemporary project. It's that independent historical investigation that brings me to you, but it is my hope that that contemporary project is what will keep you interested in the work of the Bioethics Commission. This is the independent historical investigation. I commend it and hope you all will read it. Happy to get you copies. It is available online. I'm going to talk it. This talk is largely about it. So we started work in January. We have a staff of approximately 15 people and some wonderful historians and senior advisors, among them Dr. Lombardo. So we've devoted a good part of the last 9 months to developing this investigation. The timeline Susan has already walked through. The methods of our investigation. At the end of the day, we turned over approximately 125,000 different pages of records from across this country. We did go to Guatemala. We were able to visit their archives. We were unable to collect records from their archives due to legal constraints in their country. We reviewed over 550 published documents. We consulted an independent syphilologist with a fair degree of experience, and we prepared what we call the subject database. Susan described to you how there was a real large set of documents at Pittsburgh. We had all those documents, and they were the records that Dr. Cutler had retained about this experiment. What we found is that they had references to individuals in all different ways, in all different shapes and sizes and spelling and what have you. And at the end of the day, the commission took the view that it was their responsibility to say whatever could be said about any individual involved in that experiment. And in order to do that, we had to create a database with everybody's name and every piece of information we could learn about them, deduplicate, sort, and analyze. So the numbers that are contained in our report about people come from that effort. In short, two different kinds of experiments, intentional exposure as well as serology. The serology experiments were about effectively diagnosing syphilis. Intentional exposure, you've got, I think it's five different methods: sexual intercourse, skin contact, direct injection, scarification, abrasion, and cisternal punctures, that's through the neck. The populations involved were commercial sex workers. The commercial sex workers sometimes had disease and sometimes were infected with disease by the researchers. Prisoners, Guatemalan soldiers, psychiatric hospital patients. I'm going to pause for a moment on that. Well, I'll get to the purpose in a moment. But what we found and became a really important point of the commission's thinking, was the experiments and the populations and the methods were in many respects really all over the place. And so in the back of this report, I won't hold it up because you can't see it, but we attempt to illustrate how they begin with one population in one place, then go to another before they have results. It's very, has an air of randomness to it that at least the commission felt was perhaps more serious than the air of randomness we might all say sometimes attaches to experimental work. The serology work involved blood draws, but it also involved lumbar punctures and cisternal punctures. Again, you've got the back of the neck and the base of the spine. Populations were generally the subjects from the intentional exposure, as well as children from the orphanage and the school, leprosarium patients, and some U.S. Air Force personnel stationed down in Guatemala. So the original goal, put yourselves in December 1945 in Staten Island, New York. You have the researchers of the venereal disease research lab. You have the fellow, Juan Funes, whom Susan alluded to. And they VDRL has a chemical cream, Orvis Mefarsin, and they want to test it for prophylaxis on syphilis. And they want to do it through a so-called normal exposure with commercial sex workers in a contained population, the prison. One of the ironies of that original goal is that, and Kate will correct me, in fact, that particular design actually never happened. There was never an actual prophylaxis test, normal exposure in the prison. So that's an irony here, but understand it. In any event, no record of the subjects giving any consent, and more than that, the commission found of importance active efforts to deceive. Some of the subjects, including those with mental illness in children, did not have capacity to consent. Susan highlighted for you one of the quotes that we found most compelling in the correspondence, a real recognition of the failure to give consent among some of these populations. And more importantly, intentionally deceived people about the nature of the study. The correspondence was what was really ripe for this, and quite interesting. The institutional support at the end of the day, you have the venereal disease divisions, money, paid for a grant. One of the interesting things for anybody who's a historian of NIH and its grant-making system is this grant was among the very first of the system that we know today. The Public Health Service Act changed in 1944 and created an authority to create the system that you have today. And the first study section out of that system, this was one of the proposals put before it. So it's kind of interesting. In any event, the money went to the Pan American Sanitary Bureau as a grant. They're an existing independent organization. You all can read what they contributed, and it's in many respects, and I'll use this phrase judiciously, model of collaborative activity. But there you have it. The model of grant making in 1946 is the same as it is today, give or take. You had a study section, you had an advisory council, and in this case you had not the NIH director but the Surgeon General. I commend to you again in the report, and Dr. Lombardo may talk about what one of the things about this story which I think is somewhat distinguishing is the evidence that we have that shows the Surgeon General having a real hand in the activity and real knowledge of it. And you had on-the-ground visits. So a lot of people, when I've talked about this, have said to me, well, they maybe really didn't know, but you've got on-the-ground site supervision. You've got, from a small group of people, a fair degree of knowledge and engagement. So the staffing. From the U.S., you got the chief of the venereal disease division, the director of the venereal disease research lab, the chief of the research grants office, who coincidentally used to be the deputy director of the venereal disease division, and two surgeon generals from the venereal disease lab. But I think of importance, and what I hope historians and public health students will study over the decades, is you also had a fairly heavy involvement of the government of Guatemala and their senior officials. And you, our evidence at least suggests you have relatively fair knowledge among those individuals. They were collaborating on the research. They published together. One of the documents included in an appendix in our report shows that, at least in the asylum, you had intentional infection being undertaken by some of the collaborating physicians in Guatemala. So I mentioned to you our subject database. At the end of the day, These are the numbers the commission came up with regard to people. I want to emphasize that point because I mentioned to you earlier, somewhat, for lack of a better expression, randomness of some of the experiments in the experimental design. At the end of the day, the commission decided to count individuals exposed. They may have been exposed more than once. They may have been exposed only once. But that's what this number represents. Similarly, they counted individuals who showed any record of treatment. Essentially, what the commission decided was you had a time in history where the researchers themselves were very uncertain about the effectiveness of various treatment regimens. You had anxiety and difficulty diagnosing syphilis, not so much with gonorrhea, but with syphilis you did. And you had just bad record keeping. So that sort of culmination of facts led the commission to decide they did not wish to make an opinion about the effectiveness of any treatment or the effectiveness of infection. They counted exposure and they counted who got any record of treatment. I leave to you all to think about whether or not if you expose somebody to a disease, you do or do not have an obligation to offer them available treatment. People can debate that. But so what this number shows you is our count is approximately 1,300 individuals exposed one or more times to an STD, and that's gonorrhea, syphilis, or chancroid. 678 of whom show any record of treatment. I can say to you that one of the things, while the commission did not attempt to distinguish the effectiveness of various treatment regimens, they can say with some certainty that at least one of the populations received no penicillin at all, and that's the commercial sex workers. And we have doubts about a good number of subjects, as you can infer from that number. Diagnostic testing, that's the syphilis, the serology, 5,100, 820 of whom show some record of treatment. Obviously, though, it's important to recognize that the serology testing was about developing an effective tool to diagnose the disease, syphilis. We might assume, and I would, that many of those people didn't have syphilis. We didn't infect them with syphilis. So the fact that only 820 show some record of treatment is not necessary. I don't think you can draw the same conclusions that you might draw about the previous figure. The age ranges in the intentional exposure of 10 to 72 years old, and the diagnostic testing was 1 to 18. So what did the commission conclude? I mentioned to you at the beginning the commission is an ethics commission. They're composed of ethicists, lawyers, theologians, medical practitioners, practicing scientists. And what's important, I think, they focused on the Terre Haute history, and they reached their conclusions, I think, through different avenues, but they all reached a consensus. For some, the fact that the same laboratory, many of the same researchers, 2 years before going to Guatemala, went through a heavy examination of what would be required from a consent perspective to expose people to gonorrhea intentionally, which is what happened in Terre Haute, and they decided they had to get consent. We reproduced the consent form in our report. And then they go 2 years later to Guatemala and affirmatively don't engage in consent and, in fact, actively deceive people. And so you've got different ways of getting there. Some looked at that history. Some of my members looked at their perspective on well-known, trodden, understood in the day, 46 to 48, rules about you don't expose people to illness, you don't harm them without their permission, etc. The point I'm trying to make to you is that this diverse group of people from diverse perspectives, nevertheless, in this case, reached the conclusion that not only moral wrongs were carried out, but some of those participants were morally culpable. And they didn't mince words, I don't think, on that. They have an extensive chapter on ethical assessment, and they bring the evidence together in a lot of ways that I think, although I encourage all of you to read and debate yourselves, reaches a fairly firm conclusion. The basis of their ethical analysis, faulty scientific design. And I say that not lightly, and I say that with recognition that it's easy to look back at somebody's science and criticize it. That's an easy exercise. But notwithstanding that, and knowing that many of my members are practicing scientists, they get that. But their point was, even in the midst of that reality, in this case, they felt that they were designed so poorly and executed so poorly that it was one of two critical pillars of their ethical analysis. Moreover, the failure to obtain consent. And I'm well familiar with the notion that today we have standards of consent that we didn't have then in terms of regulations and compliance guidance and rules and all that. But even at that point in time, as I've tried to emphasize, the commission found there was well and solid evidence for believing that these researchers in this context should have gotten consent. Public reaction has been very strong, as Susan alluded, and I think from a bioethics commission perspective, one of the things that's been rewarding is I do believe this is one of two examples in U.S. history where you've had a national bioethics commission, and I'm just putting the Tuskegee Syphilis Commission aside for the moment, but the Radiation Committee in the mid-90s, sponsored by Clinton, and this commission, sponsored by Obama, that has looked at a historical activity on the part of the United States involving human subjects, and the only that involves an international component. This is more of the same in terms of a broad-spread reaction to it. I think for the commission, the Lancet editorial was particularly compelling because it's forward-looking, and it, I think in many respects, makes the point Susan's been raising to you this morning, that notwithstanding facts that we might find distinguishing in this case, there is a lesson to think about our own activity moving forward. And the commission emphasized that in their conclusions, that it reminds us never to think of ethics requirements as barriers, which they procedures can be, but the core ethical requirement oughtn't be treated as a barrier. Many people ask me about the activity of the government of Guatemala, so I'm just jumping to the question. It is true that they created an independent commission. We met with their commission, and it is my understanding that they will issue a report, but it has been pending for some time. I don't know when. Moving forward, basically, the commission takes the view that I think and hope all of you would, that again, our need to understand the ethics rules is critical, because if not, we run risk of these blind spots that Susan alludes to. We meet in Boston in November. I would encourage everybody to come, because it's that public engagement. This is part of public engagement, and it's pretty critical to the commission and its effectiveness. I did allude to you that these reports are available. I would be more than happy to ship copies to you, your students, etc. We try to write a story that is comprehensible, is clear, and is well documented. So I will leave to you all to decide if we succeeded. And with that, I'd like to introduce Dr. Lombardo.
Thank you. Oh, no. Oh, damn. Shoot. Okay, hold on. Ah, got it.
Great.
Twice is the charm.
Let's see, I think I'm already going forward when I should be going backwards. Okay. Well, my goal is to raise a few questions, and these continue to pop up as they have for most of the last year. I learned of this story pretty much the same way that everyone else did, which was through a phone call from somebody saying, "Oh my gosh, did you see what Susan Reverby did?" And I quickly rolled over in bed and pulled up the computer and said, "Hi, how about that?" The material in the Cutler files is overwhelming. The other material that is available is even more overwhelming. So in some senses, this is the beginning of a story rather than an end. But happily, I don't have to give you the ending. I just want to tell you some of the musings that I've had as I've gone through this information. And heard responses from my colleagues and from the public. I'm not going to take a whole lot of time because I want to leave space for discussion and questions. But here are my five questions. I've probably got 100 questions, but I'll just start with five. The first one is, why in the world did Dr. Cutler leave these records intact? if you've ever done any kind of historical research in an archive, and this is really the first question that's been bothering me ever since I heard about Susan's article. You know, when you go into the archive, maybe you have an idea of a trail that you're on, and you hope that there will be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. Usually, there's not. But sometimes you get on that trail, and it's very clear, and you're on your way, and suddenly, where the pot of gold should be, there's nothing. And everything around it's there. The rainbow's still there. Everything is there pointing to that spot. And you say to yourself, what happened to that box? What happened to that file, the one that I really wanted? And it's easy then to come up with conspiracy theories, especially if you're, you know, racing to catch the plane, and you say somebody hid that, or they stole it, or they threw it away, or whatever. And oftentimes you find that it was just lost, or you don't know what happened to it. There's that old cliche about how absence of evidence is not evidence of absence, or maybe it's the reverse, but in any event, it's just not there. And sometimes you'll go to another archive and find copies of the letters you were looking for at the first one, and then you wonder again, why was it not there? Well, this is the opposite story. This is the story in which if you had told me, there was this fellow named Cutler who was involved in Tuskegee, and by the way, he also was involved in something which was terribly horrific down in Guatemala, I would have said, good luck finding those records. So this is a strange story from a historian's point of view. Why are these records there? Why in 1990, some, you know, 40 some odd years after the fact, does Dr. Cutler decide to give these records to the University of Pittsburgh? He was a young man when they were generated. He was a much older man when he left them. These are records that are painfully detailed on the kinds of experiments that were carried out, the people who were involved, what they knew, how they worked to limit the reputation that would follow them, how they covered up the ongoing progress of the study, even among their colleagues. So given the risk to his reputation that Dr. Cutler certainly must have understood by the time of his death. Remember, this is a man by then who has been interviewed on national television and quite embarrassed by his own response to his involvement in the Tuskegee study. So he knows how people react to this kind of thing. And nevertheless, he leaves these records. This is an extraordinary puzzle to me. Why didn't he just not deep six them, a phrase we learned from the Nixon era and Watergate? Well, I have some theories, but I think they are, at this point, they seem a little too much like psychohistorical speculation for me to spend a lot of time on them. I'd be happy to get into them in the Q&A if you'd like. But this remains an enormous problem for me. Why in the world, of all of the things he might have saved, and my understanding is he didn't save much of anything else. Nothing else there. Why does he leave these there? So that's the first question. My second question is, what about our colleagues in Guatemala? We traveled in May to the archives of Central America in Guatemala City. There had been some discussion. I know some of my colleagues in bioethics had speculated that there would be nothing there because, after all, not enough resources to maintain a good archive. I found that to be completely wrong. We met people who have lived in a tradition which really comes from the great archive in Seville, Spain, the Archive of the Americas. And the Archive of Guatemala City is really the Archive of Central America, which picks up in the 1540s, just about the time that the one in Spain starts to turn the page on American exploration. So there is a tradition and a great pride in capturing important documents and records, particularly government documents. And we were treated to an exercise of seeing people. One story we were told was about a man who at an advanced age had retired from his job and decided he wanted to go to the university. And in order to get in the university, he had to produce records that he'd gone through the secondary schools. But all he had to do was to go down to the archive, because there they were. Every grade school mark that he got was still there in the archive. So this was not some place that didn't know how to do good archival capture and preparation. And we met some very really dedicated professionals. who are carrying out their charge in a really challenging situation with limited resources. And to date, they haven't released a report, but we know that some of the records they have access to, this is the room that we met in, they have access to things like the police archives. And at the time of this study, this was a police archive in a very regulated dictatorship. And people were tracked, particularly people in regulated industries. And you got to remember that prostitution was a regulated industry, so there was a card for every woman who was involved, and every time she was stopped by the police, every time she was checked, every time she went through medical checks. So they have this kind of detail. I wonder what kind of insight we will get from those records. It's hard to know, given the political situation, whether the committee down there will be able to complete its work anytime soon. But if it does, if it ever does, it might well have a large impact on the way we look at this history and the way that we tell the story of the public health service in Guatemala, which so far has been told almost entirely from the United States point of view. I'm reminded that we talk about drama and melodrama. One of my favorite turns when I was an English teacher years ago was to have students look at read Beowulf and then read John Gardner's fictional treatment in the 1970s, I think it was, called Grendel, which is Beowulf told from the point of view of the monster. Point of view means a lot when you're talking about monstrous situations. My third question is, again, about that study section. What did they know? When did they know it? By the way, this is a trope which you're hearing over and over again, and it was really Valbonum's idea to look at these events from the perspective of those of us who grew up during Watergate, of trying to figure out where the lines of authority were, trying to figure out what the facts were, and who knew what those facts were at the time. And so I keep coming back to this. What did the study section know? As we were in the process of seeking out other sources that might provide insight about what happened in Guatemala, one of the most obvious places to look was the records of members of the study section who monitored the flow of the funds, who were experts in the same scientific areas. And some of those records were recovered in government archives. I can tell you that the staff, and I take no credit for this at all, because this was work done by the staff members who went to extraordinary lengths to track down leads about people who in many ways were obscure and whose papers are scattered all over the country. The study section was, this picture of the study section tells you how important some of those people were. It included some of the most prominent STD researchers in the country at the time. Not only Dr. Joseph Moore, shown at the end of the table there from Johns Hopkins, a leading figure in syphilology, but also his colleagues at Hopkins, Harry Eagle and John Turner, John Stokes, the author of the famous text about syphilis, which anyone who's ever studied has probably referred to, and then John Mahoney, the man at the VDRL, who along with his colleague Dr. Arnold were responsible for doing the first pilot test on treating syphilis with penicillin, which really set the stage for what happened in Guatemala. And then John Heller, later of the National Cancer Institute, later after that of Sloan Kettering, later after that, of course, also as being implicated in Tuskegee. So this is not an obscure group. These are the best and the brightest, to refer back to another one of those cliches from the 1960s and 70s. We've done a great deal of digging in records of these men, but I think there are still other traces of this study which are yet to be discovered. Like the records in Guatemala, additional insight from those who participated in the review and the approval of the study has a likelihood of changing our minds on how we think about it. And they might also take the focus away from John Cutler, whose role was key, but he could not have done what he did alone. Without encouragement and support, perhaps critique, but at least curiosity from some of these other people. There were just too many people around to keep this a secret, and the archive read in me tells me that there's other material out there yet to be discovered. One of the lines which has been quoted in the press over and over and over is the line which Dr. Perrin spoke, talking about the merry twinkle in his eye, how this study could not have been done in America. You've heard about this comment. It's in the inescapable headlines from the study. This could have been the title, and actually some of us thought would be the title for the commission report. It turns out to be a bit too flippant, almost chillingly flippant, I would say. And so the ethically impossible line turns out to be the one that was used, and it certainly captures another part of the irony of the study. But this is Dr. Perrin. Next to Dr. Cutler, at least in my mind, the most enigmatic character in this story. And I do agree with Susan that the drama really, really comes out of the characters here. Let me remind you who Dr. Perrin was. This is a man who made his own reputation. He is known, of course, for his famous 1934 episode going to CBS radio studios on a Sunday afternoon to give a talk about his efforts to educate the American public about what were then called venereal diseases. He gives the script over to a producer, showing him what he's going to read on the air. The producer red pencils it and says, "You can't use that word, syphilis." And Perrin turns on his heel and walks out of the studio, leaving them with a half hour of dead air time. And they played Clair de Lune or something for that time. And it would have gone away, and no one would have known about that embarrassment, and no one would have even known why they were playing music instead of having a speech, but for the fact that Dr. Perrin takes it upon himself to issue a press release telling the world why there was no speech and telling them how horrible it is that America clings to ignorance rather than to knowledge and enlightenment about these terrible diseases. He makes himself into a media personality. He publishes his book several years later, Shadow on the Land, which is widely distributed and widely read. He ends up not too long before that on Time magazine's cover, so this is no shrinking violet. He goes from becoming the head of the VD division to becoming the Surgeon General along the way, stopping as in New York as the Commissioner of Health there for a young governor named Franklin Roosevelt. And of course, when Roosevelt goes to the White House, he takes over as Surgeon General. He is called in his obituaries one of the great figures of American public health in the 20th century. So my question about Dr. Perrin is, what did he mean? What did he mean by that phrase, a merry twinkle in his eye? He was successful in making VD a topic of respectable books and journals, and even a topic that was talked about in the most middlebrow publication shown here, the Reader's Digest. He became famous as a uniformed crusader who wanted to stamp out syphilis and VD, and also wanted to stamp out prostitution, and more than anything, wanted to stamp out scientific ignorance about these diseases. He said that syphilis was the last national plague to be brought under control by regimented medicine. He is a fascinating character and, in my opinion, somewhat understudied. In 1944, just before the Guatemala study was launched and just as the Second World War was about to come to an end, he made a film along with a number of other people. It was called To the People of the United States. It's actually on YouTube, and I would recommend it to you. It's about 20 minutes, and it's really fascinating. It's free, and it's out there. And in it, Dr. Perrin is introduced as the Surgeon General, and he gives a talk. It includes people like Robert Mitchum and Chill Wills, who are playing mechanics who are flying a large airplane, or they're maintaining this airplane somewhere in the South Pacific. Surgeon General Perrin is introduced, and he says, "The lifeblood of a democracy is your ability to understand and act upon a problem once the facts are presented to you. The purpose of this motion picture is to give you those facts." The rest of this film is a little melodrama, really, about an ace flyer who is grounded because he has contracted syphilis and the impact of his actions on the combat effort. At the end of this story, in which we are taken through the problems of how syphilis is transmitted and how it's appropriately treated and what every good sailor, soldier, and marine should do should he find himself confronting this disease, Surgeon General Perrin appears again. And he says, "Here we have told only part of the story of venereal disease control." Uh, untold is the fine work of our churches and schools and social agencies, what they are doing to prevent the promiscuity which spreads infection. It is important to remember that the only sure way for an individual to avoid infection is to avoid exposure. Learn the facts. With knowledge and intelligent action, the people of America can eradicate venereal diseases. This is in 1944. Well, by 1947, the same month that the researchers began their experiments on the Guatemalan army involving sexual intercourse, Dr. Robert Coatney, a public health service malariologist, wrote his colleague, Dr. Cutler, telling him about Dr. Perrin's interest in the work. And he said, "I saw Dr. Perrin on Friday. He wanted to know if I had a chance to visit your project. And since the answer was yes, he asked me to tell him about it, and I did so to the best of my ability. He was familiar with all the arrangements and wanted to be brought up to date on what progress had been made. As you well know, he is very much interested in the project, and a merry twinkle came into his eye when he said, 'You know, we couldn't do such an experiment in this country.'" Perrin goes on to complete his career, becomes dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Public Health, hires Dr. Cutler there, who works there until his retirement. Perrin died before the revelations. He died in 1968, before the revelations about Tuskegee came out. That had also happened on his watch while he was Surgeon General. But so he didn't have to answer the pointed questions that people like Cutler, or for that matter John Heller, had to answer in the 1970s. And we've already heard from Susan about how our friend Jim Jones questioned John Heller about that in 1976. So my question to end this part was Perrin's merry twinkle, because he knew that an experiment with prostitution would never be approved for the United States? Was it because his reputation as a VD fighter and opponent of commercial sex work would be destroyed if people heard about what was going on in Guatemala? Was it because, as he showed during the preparation for the Terre Haute prison studies, he understood the legal liability he would face in the United States for such a study? We may never know what the phrase means, but this surely remains one of the more fascinating questions to me surrounding the whole event. The final question I have has to do with what it was that motivated people to become involved in this study and what kept it going. In the film, I mentioned there is this conversation, and the conversation goes something like this. "Every time there's a war, the venereal disease rate takes a jump. It's bad enough in peacetime, but now it's like a forest fire. No organization of saboteurs could do half the damage to our army. We average 30 venereal disease cases each year out of 1,000 men in uniform. That means 300,000 men put out of action each year in a 10 million man army, and every one of those is a casualty. As far as combat is concerned, think of that, 300,000 casualties without even a battle. So the war against the Axis is painted in tones that show VD being the same kind of enemy." There is a lot of graphic evidence of this argument. It's very obvious. You see venereal disease holding up a wrench just about to crush the, looks like a drill press of some sort of lathe perhaps, the U.S. war effort. He is the enemy agent. VD is the enemy. And then we have this young lady. She may look clean cut, but you can't beat the Axis if you get VD. So again, this is about, I'm sure there will be reams written by Susan and her colleagues who are experts in gender studies as well about why it's always the girl who's at fault here. You can see that the other one says, "You may think she's just your gal, but she may be everyone's pal." And this is the direction I'm turning to. Prophylaxis prevents venereal disease. You move on a little further, the connection between the real enemy and VD is made even more patent. Here we have Hitler and Hirohito, and again, lovely lady VD in the middle there. She's the worst of the three. And finally, in the most dramatic and explicit sense, we have a connection made between the real enemies, stock pictures of Hitler and Hirohito, and there on the top, Ms. G.I. Pickup of 1944, the duet to defeat. She is our sunshine. She makes us happy through bombings blue. The Russians rush us. The Yankees crush us. She'll give the VD to you and you and you. So you don't have to be a film critic to realize that what's going on here is an attempt to equate the war effort with the effort to stamp out VD. And the enemy, the Axis, the Germans and the Japanese, real enemies on par with this spirochete. Now, what does this have to do with Guatemala? Well, every soldier knew, because they had to sit through training programs and films like the one I pointed out, every soldier knew that you were supposed to use prophylaxis. And prophylaxis meant two things. Probably to most people it meant use condoms. But it also was part of the regimen that was legally mandated that if a person went off base and was exposed to, i.e. had sex with, someone who was infected, they had a legal obligation to come back to the base and report that to the doctor. And the doctor then put them through a really messy and uncomfortable process of slathering them up with ointments and salves that contained arsenicals and mercury and other kinds of things, sometimes injecting various solutions into their genitals. It was not a pleasant business. And that, too, was called prophylaxis because it was meant to interrupt, to prevent the seroconversion, to interrupt the chain of infection if you did it fast enough. At least that was the theory. So you see here, sex exposure without prophylaxis is pro-axis, again, connecting the disease and the war effort. And then the final one, fight syphilis and gonorrhea, avoid exposure, avoid pickups and prostitutes. If exposed, use prophylaxis. If infected, see a medical doctor. Well, it turns out that prophylaxis, in the sense that I'm talking about it, as a way of preventing seroconversion, was precisely what the study in Guatemala was designed, at least originally, to get at. In the war against VD, the medical officers were the real generals. It's important to remember that the Terre Haute prison studies were about developing a new prophylaxis, not condoms, but a chemical prophylaxis that could be given to the troops before or maybe just after exposure to prevent seroconversion. And the work at Guatemala initially focused on using these chemical means, including this newest silver bullet, penicillin, as an agent that would be applied immediately after exposure to prevent disease spread. So prophylaxis, in this sense, takes on a slightly new meaning, at least new in the general mind as opposed to the medical mind. The role of the medical officer clearly is an important part of this. And the importance to developing this new technology, even as the war was ending, could hardly be missed. I think that the moral of the story is that winning the next war, really the unquestioned motive was national security. And I wonder how much this was a factor in pushing the investigators who launched and carried out the studies in Guatemala, how much they shared this motive, how much it should be highlighted in a list of danger signs whenever ethical and legal corners are being cut to the detriment of research subjects. So that's my last question. It seems to me that I don't have clear answers to any of those. We have a lot of evidence we could talk about. The final point is to come back to the beginning when Susan said this is an attempt to stay away from melodrama. I made a little note of the possible ways we might go in this, thinking of how we used to talk about this back in poetry class. You know, drama was about ambiguity. Melodrama was about certitude. Melodrama was about things being fixed and knowing who the good guys and the bad guys were, kind of like a medieval morality play where they had signs saying virtue and vice. And whereas drama was about contingency and complexity. The focus of melodrama often is moralism. We know who the bad guys are. We know who we are going to condemn. We know who we are going to have contempt for. Whereas in drama, we identify with the characters. We identify them, as the Greeks told us, because we're afraid we're like them. It's that business of fear and pity. And at some point that leads us to some kind of tolerance. How to avoid making out the people who ran the Guatemala study as a monster while realizing at the same time that they did monstrous things. That's the real hard part here. I'm not sure that I've solved it, but I hope I've at least raised some questions. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I don't know if someone can figure out how to put the lights back up so we can actually see you, but there's a mic out there. We're interested in your comments. Please identify yourself and speak loudly, especially for us aging ears up front here, or at least mine. Thank you.
Two questions. Jill Gay, former IRB member, NIAID, and www.whatworksforwomen.org. Two questions. One is, can one of you review the history of Guatemala during this time? The coup, or if
thank you.
None of you know, perhaps someone is here from Guatemala who could sort of help us with sort of frame the political picture from
right.
the Guatemalan time.
Right.
And the second question is what efforts you've made to bring this into training for NIH researchers.
Right. A quick thing on it. This is actually considered sort of the liberal period, is the Arbenz government. So this is before the CIA engineers the coup in 1954. So that one of the things, I'm going to a conference, I have a better answer probably in another month. There's a conference at the University of Texas that's going to look at sort of how this is changing the way Guatemalan people are thinking about this in terms of the Guatemalan history. So this is actually considered one of the liberal periods in Guatemala. And in terms of its impact on NIH training, my great worry about this, I have written elsewhere that there's been kind of what I call the bioethics holy trinity, you know, which you'll excuse me, is sort of like, you know, Tuskegee, Willowbrook, and Jewish Chronic Disease Hospital. So now we're going to add Guatemala to the fourth point, and I'm worried that it's just going to be too simple. It's going to be one of those IRB training things where you learn the three things and push the button, and then you pass, and then you won. And I think our job is exactly what Paul's talking about, to make I think the more that you can imagine yourself as a researcher doing what Cutler did, then we will have learned something. I think it's dangerous to think of him only as monstrous. I just, even though we actually think what they did is monstrous, but to imagine that you could make that mistake will help you learn, I think, from this. And I think it's going to be our job to try to think about how to make this more complex as people use it.
Yeah, Val?
Paul? No, I think that's the... That is the point. The 54 is the point of the coup, and all this was pretty much done by then. Perhaps our next question can be clarified more.
Right.
Okay, Marvin, I am from Guatemala. It actually became more relevant, because it was even before the Advent period, it was during the Arevalo period, which was not completely against the U.S., but a little bit more U.S. friendly than the Arevalo period was. So that even gained even more relevance for the Guatemalan media. So now you have the right-wing Guatemalan saying, see, that very nice revolutionary period, 10 years that you had, was not that nice. So there's always this argument, was it really a government policy to be in the study, or it was just Funes? Because one of the reasons why Funes was sent over to Staten Island was because Arevalo wanted to put Guatemala in the forefront of this syphilis treatment in Central America and the region, and that's where Bach also came in. Now, the other question would be, would this fit into the word torture? Because so far in Guatemala, and I have my hands in the part of the report of the Guatemalan report, and I haven't read the U.S. report yet, but I haven't read the word torture so far. I mean, medical experiments without informed consent, would that be considered torture?
I'm not an international, maybe the lawyers, I should ask the lawyers to think about this. At the time, the issue about not consent is still being debated. As the commission made clear, there was consent in, although you could argue about whether it counts as consent when you're in a prison. And the story that I often tell is my father did some early research on penicillin at what was called Michael Reese Hospital in Chicago on bacterial endocarditis, which was then a death sentence for patients. And I said to him, before he passed away, I said, so Dad, what kind of informed consent did you do in 1946, on this? And he said, I told the patient he didn't try this new drug, penicillin, he would die. That's what looked like, which in fact was the truth, but was the kind of informed consent, I think, that was fairly common. Now, on the question of whether this counts in some legal sense as torture, I think we're going to have to, one of the questions is if you do what, you infect people and don't tell them, that's one question. And then if you infect people and they get the disease and you treat them, is it torture? If you infect them, they get the disease, and then you treat them, what is it then? So I think this is a kind of legal. I'm going to turn over to the two lawyers to my right and ask them to answer you.
Well, this is a fascinating question. I don't have an answer for you, but it has, throughout the last
several months struck me more than a few times that the excuses used to talk about what was going on in Guatemala versus what happened in a similar situation in the U.S., the language that has been used is talking about ethics. Now, as a lawyer, I have to say that I found that conversation less than satisfying, because I think what was going on in Terre Haute was an attempt to make sure that people who were in a study had assumed the liability. That's a legal term. Let's tell them, says Dr. Moore, they have to know voluntarily, they have to know up front what's going on, because, another member of the review panel says, some lawyers liable to get a hold of this and say that they didn't consent. So the concerns were not about the dignity of the person and the permeability of the, you know, the human temple and other such things. They were simply about legal liability. Going to this question in international law, is treatment or is non-treatment in a study equivalent to torture? I don't know that there's a legal answer for that, and it would probably be different from case to case. It's similar to asking whether there's some kind of moral equivalence between non-treatment, say, a Tuskegee study, and infection in the Guatemala study. I don't know how you make those moral equivalents, so I don't really have an answer.
And I would qualify somewhat. I think that Paul's point about legal liability being the driver in the 40s, I'm sorry, is an important one, but at least from my own perspective, now speaking from my own perspective, not necessarily that of the commission, it's important to recognize that in some ways you get to the same place, that you have acknowledgement well documented in 43 to 44, and I would argue documented, if nothing else, by some of the circumstantial information of a recognition of the need to engage individuals and have them agree. Whether you believe it's true because of a ethical view of responsibility or because of a legal view of responsibility, I think those are important distinctions, but I'm not sure that in some ways there's such an important distinction from the bottom line. And that, I try to emphasize, the commission, in my view, reached their conclusions from different angles, but they all reached the same conclusion that the activities of Guatemala in this circumstance, for these people, clearly, if you will, over the line, so that we would draw the line. And I think it was important. I also, I agree with Paul, the legal points of torture is a complicated question, and we often employ contemporary notions of human rights to think about it, and I'm not in a position to gauge the rightness or wrongness of that strategy, but it's important to remember that while I think there's some consensus from the ethics community in the United States that for so-called healthy people who were not there because they were in a hospital, by that I mean not before the researchers because they were in a hospital, but before the researchers because they're in a prison and they're not sick, or they're in a prison, the commercial sex workers, the soldiers, those people were not sick and therefore presenting for experimentation, they were quote normal subjects. There's a fair consensus, I would argue to you, that in that context, you have to get consent from people. I don't disagree with my colleague that for many people, that was probably a legal liability driver that I would profit in some ways. It's still the same standard.
No, I would agree. I mean, I think it is the same standard. But the only kind of speculative kind of comment I was making was whether or not, in the minds of the people at the time, this had to do with notions of human dignity or human rights, or whether it was just a liability thing.
Right.
And I don't think that's an answerable question, but it's an interesting kind
right.
of thing to talk about.
And Emmanuel?
My name is Anne Emmanuel Byrne. I'm a historian of public health in Latin America. And I have a question about the war framing and war context from a slightly different angle. And that is, in 1942, the U.S. State Department set up a massive public health aid program from the U.S. to Latin America, building hospitals, clinics, a large amount of infrastructure with very little subtlety to its effort. It was trying to fend off German influence and Axis influence in Latin America. And of course, during the 1930s, German pharma, as well as medical instrumentation and other forms of exchange and trade were growing massively. So my question is, To what extent was there any interaction between Cutler's study and what was going on at the in the State Department Cooperative Aid Program, which was run by Nelson Rockefeller? And was there any kind of moral quid pro quo being proffered? That is, since we're investing in Guatemala in a larger public health infrastructure, then it's on some level justifiable that we carry out the study.
That's a great question. I had a dozen more slides, and one of the slides was a picture from 1924 when the International VD conference was held in Jamaica. And in the Jamaican newspaper was a picture of all of the doctors who were there, and the conference had been convened by the Medical Department of United Fruit, which was the company which in essence ran Guatemala along with a lot of other places. The connection between government interests, commercial corporate interests, and health is fascinating. Frankly, I'm sure you're much more of an expert in that than I am. And I don't know the answer to your question, but it would be interesting. It would be an interesting one to follow up on, because the presence of when we went to Guatemala, I was sort of taken back by a plaque we saw on one of the sites where these experiments were carried out, which included the general whose name escapes me now, who was running the country at the time in 1937, and it also said we thank the Rockefellers. And you coming from the Public Health Service, Surgeon General Cumming was in charge then. Surgeon General Cumming then goes to become, as did many of his successors, the head of the Pan American Center, which becomes PAHO. So I like to describe PAHO as a wholly owned subsidiary of the Public Health Service at that time. How all of these interests mix together geopolitically, financially, and otherwise is a subject for somebody else's book.
We didn't find any evidence that specifically drew those connections. We did make the point that there was this big effort at Roosevelt Hospital was being built, and you had an Air Force Base, you had perhaps I hesitate to use the word friendly, but you had a system in place. We weren't alone going into Guatemala, because we found no direct evidence on that.
We have time for one more question. Martha, I'm really sorry. We're running out of the next session is going to come in.
My name is Simon Miller. I'm a physician in Chicago. I was curious if there's anyone can comment about the situation that happened in Willowbrook Hospital in the 70s around hepatitis being injected into children and the implications of that. And also quickly, or not so quickly, the fact that, the government now feels it can do a lot of things extrajudicially or something as far as, killing citizens or whatever for justifiable reasons, I guess they would say. What does that mean for public health in terms of going to some countries and doing things that are undercover of this nature that are justified by quote-unquote war?
Right.
There was something about the CIA doing something regarding immunizations that I can't remember the specifics of recently.
Right.
Right.
Well, I think one of the things, Val said, and maybe this is a good place to end, encourage you to send materials to the Bioethics Commission to show up at their meeting in Boston. And one of the things that's left for their job, their two prongs, as Val said, of what they have to do is this historical work has now been finished. What's important now is the kinds of issues around the protection of human subjects, particularly in international trials. They've had a meeting with people to look at this internationally. There's a report coming out by the end of the year. Is that correct? So I think that you should talk to her and to Paul about this, and we look forward to your going out and talking about this with the audiences that you speak to on a regular basis. And Val, want to finish?
I just want to add one more point on to the individual who asked about training. The commission is currently looking into taking the Guatemala report and maybe developing some kind of a curriculum or something, because we didn't do an executive summary by design. We really would like to read the whole report. It is a little long in detail, but we did that on purpose. But so issues of training and what NIH or others might do, of course we defer to them, but we are looking into trying to figure out how to engage more actively on the story, so we would welcome suggestions for that department.
Thank you very much for coming. We appreciate it.